Good day and welcome to Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jesrich. This is a quote. So long as every institution of today, economic, political, social, and moral, conspires to misdirect human energy into wrong channels, so long as most people are out of place doing the things that they hate to do, living a life they loathe to live, crime will be inevitable, and all the laws and the statutes can only increase but never do away with crime. That was written by one of the most interesting and dynamic anarchists in U.S. history, Emma Goldman, in a piece called Anarchism, What It Really Stands For. She also wrote that, quote, the inherent tendency of the state is to concentrate, to narrow, to monopolize all social activities. The nature of evolution is, on the contrary, to grow, to broaden, and disseminate itself in ever-widening circles. In other words, the state is institutional and static. Revolution is fluent and dynamic. U.S. Attorney Frances Caffey in 1917 said, Emma Goldman is a woman of great ability and of personal magnetism, and her persuasive powers are such to make her an exceedingly dangerous woman, and a young J. Edgar Hoover, ready to build his career by pursuing anarchist, called Emma Goldman the most dangerous woman in America. During a time of cyclical economic boom and bust, anarchist bombings, presidential assassinations, and crackdown on dissent, Emma Goldman could hold the title of most provocative person in the United States during the late 19th and early 20th centuries, if not of all time. Emma Goldman, however, would see herself as just promoting free love, an equal and free society, birth control, and the love of art and literature. Another famous quote attributed to Emma Goldman, but we'll be discussing whether or not it actually came to her, is, if I can't dance, I don't want your revolution. A Russian Jew who immigrated to the U.S. as a teenager, Emma Goldman got her political education in the slums of New York's East Side by hanging out with the likes of anarchist thinkers Peter Kropotkin and Johann Most. Later on, she toured the United States giving lectures when she could. A number of city and states barred her mere presence, and she was arrested a number of times. Eventually, she was deported to Russia, where she grew disillusioned with the Russian Revolution, though towards the end of her life, she also was inspired by the Spanish Civil War. To talk more about the life and times of Emma Goldman, I'm joined by Dr. Candace Falk, author of the book Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman, a biography. She's also director of the Emma Goldman Papers, which is based but not funded at UC Berkeley. Candace Falk, it is great to have you here.
Pleasure to be here.
In understanding Emma Goldman, it's important to understand the times she lived in. She was born in 1869 and again as a teenager came to the United States. From the late 1880s to the lead up of really World War I, this was really a volatile period in this country's history. Talk to me about the times.
It was an amazing time of activism, of people having a vision that they want, of recognizing that there was something wrong, of strikes happening all over the country, of progressive reformers hoping to make a difference. It was a time when suffragists were taking power and would soon get the vote. It was a time of a shift from a less urban to a more urban industrial base of the society. It was a time when women had much more freedom than they had had before, and yet convention of marriage and family and was still very much part of their life.
And it was being able to vote itself.
And being able to vote itself. Right. But Emma Goldman herself was fascinating in that she understood that all the kinds of changes that were happening, which is why she was such an interesting figure at a time when there was so much turbulence and social movements, both in labor and in the more bohemian artistic communities, is that she believed that freedom was both external and internal. And her anarchist vision was one in which there would be an equitable society that would be self-governing. But your freedom, as she said to the suffragists, could not be bought and won at the voting booth.
Yeah.
But in your soul, it must begin in a woman's soul. And in that sense, in the her words and her message always carried a personal and political element to them, so that people who weren't anarchists identified with her vision, whether they thought it was realistic or not. And they were much more open to it because it was a time of turbulence, a time of change. And people were thinking about change, excited about change. And the, although she may have been considered somewhat sectarian, like all the different people on the left then and now are, there was much more crossover.
She served that bridge, didn't she?
She certainly served that bridge, less so with socialists, where she would often be debating the difference between socialism and anarchism and making sure to say that an anarchist vision was not hierarchical. But she served an incredible bridge position in two ways that may seem completely opposite but were related. One was when there was something violent happening.
Mm-hmm.
If the president was killed, which happened during her lifetime.
Don't get into that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If something happened like that, while she didn't partake in such activities formally.
She was sympathetic to it.
What she was sympathetic to was the level of desperation someone would feel to do something like that. And she was like a translator of what that might mean. So very often her talks about an event that otherwise would seem incomprehensible and quite reprehensible, she would be able to not exactly forgive it, but to explain it, to make it clear why, to really educate people about that.
Well, we're jumping a little bit ahead, but let me ask you about that.
Mm-hmm.
She defended in the paper the assassin of William McKinley in 1901.
Mm-hmm. She didn't defend his act directly. What she did defend was the political philosophy and the internal life of somebody who would do that. In other words, she felt that this was not that you couldn't turn your back on somebody who believed that they were doing something for the cause of freedom, even if you didn't agree with them. And that was where she stood. And her own relationship to the issue of violence is very complex. One of the things that I think is interesting is that her definition of anarchism was quite expansive.
Mm-hmm.
And so in terms of the means, she said in her article on anarchism and what it really means, that all anarchists agree that as they do in their opposition to political machinery, that methods must grow out of the economic needs of each place and clime and of the intellectual and temperamental requirements of the individual. The serene, calm character of a Tolstoy will wish different methods for social reconstructions than the intense, overflowing personality of a Mikhail Bakunin or Peter Kropotkin. And so, equally so, it must be apparent that economic and political needs of Russia will dictate more dramatic measures than would England or America. In other words, she thought that there were different there was a spectrum. And that spectrum, she may not have thought that was the most effective, but she didn't want to leave anyone abandoned in their highest wishes. But what I wanted to say, even more importantly, is that she lived in a time when freedom of expression was much more contested than people realize. So that if she spoke about birth control, for example, there were laws about obscenity and obscenity through the mail, and speaking about obscenity and birth control was considered.
Is this the Comstock call?
This is the Comstock Act.
Yeah.
And but
what was that?
It was an act that it was actually an act that by a person named Comstock, who was a post office administrator, who said that obscene material could not go through the post.
Yeah.
And what that meant was birth control information, human anatomy information, you name it. And lots of things were considered. It was a very vague definition. What I wanted to say...
Well, when we say birth control, though, what do we mean? And Emma Goldman was a big proponent of birth control during this time. What was birth control like in the early 1900s?
Birth control was rather elementary. I mean, it was very, there weren't birth control pills.
Right.
There were various, like, things called pessaries and insertions and things that might seem a little bit sort of similar to the things that we have that are plastic now.
Like condoms.
Condoms, forgetting what the diaphragms. But also, even to understand the rhythm method, even understanding that was considered a no-no. We're not supposed to teach women about their own reproductive body, that was considered obscene. And what I wanted to say is that here we're talking about violence and sexuality. Well, very often it was much easier for Emma to give a talk of trying to explain labor violence, for example, than it was to speak about sexuality and homosexuality, and because that seemed more threatening at the time. And so you can see that the issue of free expression was very was not only contested, but it didn't make exact linear sense. And so Emma Goldman was somebody who traveled all through the United States while she had her magazine, Mother Earth magazine, from 1906 until 1917, when it was shut down. She spoke all through the country, including here in Los Angeles, California, New York, the Midwest, small towns. And she never knew whether she would find a lock on the door or be able to speak. But what I think is amazing is...
And because authorities wouldn't allow her to speak?
Yes. Police, the federal government did not have the uniform right to enforce free speech. Mm-hmm. It was all local. And so if the police or the mayor of a certain town felt threatened by Emma Goldman, or there was enough of a... or if there was enough of a groundswell of people who wanted her there, these things changed over time. There were different places, just like now, that were considered more progressive, less progressive, and she rode the wave of that. But what I think is interesting still is that many, many people who didn't agree with what she said, who thought that her ideas about anarchism, about government, about violence, about even about homosexuality and polyandry and all this stuff was completely not what they believed in. They believed in her right to say it.
Mm-hmm.
And
but even some anarchists were not comfortable with her promotion of both birth control and also ideas of free love.
You know, that's true. but not completely. Uh-huh. There's a long history of anarchists before Emma Goldman, Moses Harman, and various other people who went to jail for love outside of marriage, mm-hmm. outside of marriage. But I think it's fair to say that you could have an ideology, but not necessarily follow it. In other words, you could say that you are totally for birth control and against marriage, but there were many, many anarchists who were married and who used birth control and, you know, didn't oppose that. But she did have, like any movement, there were people who were critical of her and people who affirmed what she said. And her particular brand of anarchism was very expansive and didn't always fit into an easy mold.
Again, we are in conversation with Dr. Candace Falk, author of the book Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman, a biography. She is also the director of the Emma Goldman Papers that is based out of UC Berkeley. And our conversation this hour is about the life and times of Emma Goldman. And for our listeners, want to let them know, I am going to bring us back in a moment to the violence and the issues of propaganda of the deed. But since we're already in the issue of birth control and free and the ideas of free love, this was also very much a part of her political ideas, an important aspect for her in realizing liberation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it was.
These were very revolutionary things at that time.
At that time. I mean, in many ways, that's why Emma seems so current. When you read her, you feel like, oh, I understand that. I understand that. And one of the things that I felt was one of the elements of her life that I found particularly poignant, which I wrote about in Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman, was that here in the love letters of hers that I found and really wrestled with myself about whether to make them public was an Emma who struggled with her own belief system, who felt like she stood on the platform for free love, for openness, for...
And then felt jealousy.
And she felt incredibly jealous of her guy, Ben Reitman, who was her lover and manager for 10 years, who literally would sometimes scan a hall where she was giving a speech, catch the eye of a woman in the audience, leave with the woman on his arms, and then come back sheepishly at the end of Emma's talk, where she would be lecturing on the subject of the false fundamentals of free love. Because clearly,
and here she was trying to reconcile that while she's giving this
talk. Right, and her lecturing her way.
And of course, she had more than one lover herself.
Definitely.
Yeah.
But what she wrote in her letters was that she felt condemned before the bar of her own reason, that she struggled terribly with herself. She felt like she had been turned into something foreign to herself. And what I think is interesting about that is that everybody, whether they're an anarchist or not, struggles with this interim phase, one hopes is the interim phase, between what you wish and the world you live in.
Yeah.
And that also includes how you wish you would respond and how you are wired to respond from your upbringing, from your environment, etc. And I think those, just knowing that Emma Goldman struggled with that she wasn't this woman on a pedestal, that she had tremendous depression at different points and struggled with her own self-confidence and yet came across so confident and gave other people confidence, is a lesson for all of us, I think, that it's important to kind of hold on to your vision.
Yeah.
See if you can drop your illusions and keep going.
She was, in talking about issues of sexuality, influenced by Sigmund Freud, who she saw lecture in Vienna.
She saw him lecture in Vienna and again at Clark University in this country.
Yeah.
And what she was influenced by was just his, well, many things, but the core being his emphasis on sexuality as a driving force in human personality and in human interactions and in the self. And in that way, I would say that although there were certainly other anarchists who wrote and spoke about those things to a certain extent, I feel like she really brought them home to people of saying, like, literally the personal is political. And what's...
Where sexual expression is liberation.
Is liberation. Now, interestingly enough, Freud might have thought that suppression of sexuality would be keep you creative. And Emma thought just the opposite.
The creativity came with the expression.
Yes, as in dancing.
As in dancing.
Yeah.
And that's something that Emma Goldman always, and I think a lot of activists today can relate to this, trying to balance, one, the joy of life, art, literature, dance, music, these things, and also a life that is dedicated to a cause. And her dedication was serious. I mean, she spent many nights in jail and was deported.
Mm-hmm. And she quoted in her autobiography that she wanted freedom, the right to self-expression, everybody's right to beautiful, radiant things. And that was her credo. Mm. And it wasn't something that was extra. It was something that you deserved, a book or a flower.
Let's back up in time a little bit here.
Yes.
And go back to a young Emma Goldman. When she first came to New York City, Lower East Side, 1889. This is when she meets up with Peter Kropotkin.
She meets up with Alexander Berkman and Johann Most at that time.
Yeah.
And it was a very, she would, first of all, she didn't speak English very well. There was a very active group of German, Russian, Slavic, Italian, Spanish immigrant radicals, each of them having their own saloon. She met Alexander Berkman and also, well, Johann Most had a newspaper, so she had gone to his press, but she met Alexander Berkman, who was to become
That's
her.
What she brought with her, right? When she got to New York City, was the address of
right,
the newspaper.
Of that newspaper.
An anarchist paper.
Yes. It was an anarchist paper that was in German.
Yeah.
That had a little socialist tinge to it. And it was a time when women came there and they smoked and they drank and they did all the things that, you know, were a no-no outside. And in that world, she found excitement, the excitement of political discussions, and I would say the excitement of discovering herself as an attractive, young, sort of firebrand.
And she just got out of a marriage when she was
coming. She had just gotten out of a marriage that was a very sad thing for her. When she came to this country, she actually, one of the reasons, apart from the tremendous anti-Semitism in Russia that she was escaping and what had afflicted her family and her community, she also was escaping the narrowness of religious orthodoxy that included arranged marriages.
Yeah.
And so this whole issue of marriage was very important. And when she came to Rochester, New York, where she lived with her sister and worked in a factory, she had fallen in love with a man who turned out to be a gambler and not very limited. And she really put him down in ways that I won't even repeat in her autobiography. And so what she did was she found herself, once she left, and she felt inspired by hearing a woman, a German socialist, Johanna Grey, speaking about the absolute heroism of the Haymarket anarchists.
Well, I wanted to bring that up. 1889 is also the year that the Haymarket Square incident happened in Chicago. Also influential.
1886 and 87.
Yep.
And 1887 is when they were hung. And that was, and they, their speeches included that their voices would be heard long after their death. And
this
that
was a radicalizing moment for
it
her.
It was an incredibly radicalizing moment. And it was a radicalizing moment on two fronts. One is that it was a woman who spoke in a mesmerizing way that reached her. Two, it was about a kind of heroism of martyrdom for cause, and a cause that was all around her, the inequities and injustices, and their death seemed so profoundly tragic to her, and she was decided that she would dedicate her life to being a voice for the ideas that they stood for. And when she came to New York, that's where she found the base and the friendships and the intensity that she longed for. And I guess you were interested in the issue of violence, so I'll just...
Well, that was my next question.
Yeah.
What is propaganda of the deed?
Propaganda by the deed is something that Emma imported. Not that it was not here, but she imported those ideas most strongly from Russia. That propaganda by the deed was choosing not random terrorism, but a person who represented injustice, who person, it was kind of a, the idea behind it was retribution for something that had happened that was outrageous. And so there were some anarchists and other people who believed, and as Emma experienced in Russia, when the Tsar was actually killed, after that, the revolution
began.
Yeah. And so to some extent, she may have she and Alexander Berkman kind of misread the American scene that way when they thought that there was a homestead lockout in Pennsylvania and Pinkertons that shot at...
Who were the Pinkertons?
Oh, they were
maybe we should back up a little bit more. Tell me more about the Carnegie Steel Company.
That was the Carnegie Steel Company. Yeah. And in Homestead, and the manager of the Carnegie
labor dispute,
and there was a lockout. And when the workers came and demanded to be able to work and to get their salaries back and this and that, they were shot upon by these detective agencies that were often hired by company business.
These were the Pinkertons.
The Pinkertons.
Yeah.
And Frick was the person.
Henry Clay Frick,
sorry.
He was the manager there.
He was the manager, and he was the person who was the point person accused of being responsible for those killings. And Alexander Berkman and Emma Goldman and another person, Fedya, whose name was Modest Stein, and several people actually who were in Pennsylvania colluded in thinking through a way to actually shoot Frick. And I have to say that as a side point, the Emma Goldman Papers now thinks that Frick may not have been as much to blame as the Pinkertons were, but mm-hmm. that's, or the Burns Detective Agency. I'm now forgetting which one.
Mm-hmm.
But that seemed like a kind of act, this heroic act that would set the match that would make the labor movement an uprise as if it was in Russia. And instead, when Alexander Berkman came into Frick's office.
Frick in the shoulder and stabbed him in the leg, but
yes,
he failed at kill. He did not assassinate him.
He did not assassinate him. And in fact, one of the workers held Alexander Berkman down so that he could be carted away by the police. And it's interesting because just like anything like that, that's the kind of thing that was very controversial people in labor movements, some of them hated that and felt like it brought a reaction against them. Other people thought, huh, good, somebody, you know, let us strike fear in the hearts of people who are killing all these other people. And Berkman spent 14 years in prison for this. And by the time he came out, he had become more of a labor hero. But in that moment.
Not at that moment.
He was villainized, of course. Yeah.
And that was the miscalculation there that Berkman and Goldman had. That was maybe the United States.
Yeah, because they were Russians.
Different.
They were Russians at the heart.
Because when you mention it, I mean, isn't that how it was assassination that kicked off World War One? Right?
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, and there were a lot of assassinations during that time.
Right.
It was a very bloody time. I mean, it was sort of fascinating that we think of this period, 1890 to, you know, especially 1910 to 1916, which is what our next book, which is coming out
right,
in 2 months.
Right, on the Goldman Papers, yeah.
Light and Shadows, literally was this moment of complete light and shadows, incredible labor violence, incredible, and at the same time, incredible creativity and vision.
Well, and again, I really want to hark on this time period, and I'm going to go maybe a few years before even sure. that period, but this all happened in 1892 with the attempted assassination, failed assassination. Mm-hmm. Berkman ends up going to jail for, what, 20 years?
He was supposed to go for 20 years, and he ended up being 14.
So he went for 14 years.
Yeah.
The following year, in 1893, this country saw the worst economic crisis up to that point.
That's true. And in fact, one of the more interesting ways that Emma Goldman links to that is there were tremendous demonstrations of the unemployed. Imagine if the unemployed now, all of the millions of unemployed right now, were organized. And so Emma spoke before a group of the unemployed at a demonstration and said, demonstrate before the houses of the rich, palaces of the rich, demand bread. If they do not give it to you, it is your sacred right to take it. And she was arrested for a year for
inciting a riot. Yeah.
And that gives you a feeling of how difficult it was to speak your mind at that time and how threatened people are about those very things at a moment of economic downturn, literal down and out turn.
We could describe this period as probably the fiercest struggle between capital and labor, couldn't we?
You know, when you're surrounded by historians, you never know whether you can say that or not.
Right.
But I would say that
as a journalist,
I would say that as a person working in that field, it was incredible.
That's what it seems like to me.
It's just incredible.
The bombings that were occurring at the time, and a time that I don't know of any other time like this in U.S. history, and a history that is not taught in school.
It is not.
I did not learn about Propaganda of the Deed in school, or Luigi Galliano,
right?
Or Galliani, or these.
Well,
type
you know,
of people.
Most people don't teach anything about anarchism, and they associate anarchism with chaos.
But Theodore Roosevelt called it the greatest threat to America. I mean, it was the boogeyman.
It was
the Al Qaeda
of
its time.
Absolutely. And after McKinley had been shot in 1901, the next year there were so many restrictions on immigration, believing that Czolgosz was an outside force who came in. Leon Czolgosz, who came in to shoot McKinley, that they actually changed the immigration laws to restrict people who were anarchists from coming into the United States. And that's fascinating in 1902 and 1903, because it was the first time. It wasn't like before, it was the horrible Chinese Exclusion Act, and now it was ideological. No,
right.
It was. And, you know, of course, there's a flaw in that, like, how do they know if you're an anarchist or not? And Emma, too, challenged that with a British syndicalist coming to the country and also brought attention to this as a First Amendment right.
They try to blame Emma Goldman for inspiring Chulgos to kill William McKinley.
They did try to do that, and they could not. And she did not. But one can see how they wanted to make the powers that be wanted to make a connection between. They wanted to find someone to blame. I mean, Leon Chulgos had the electric chair at that time, but Emma, they wanted to villainize her. We have a newspaper of photo drawing of hers in a newspaper from that time where they have Emma's picture with skull and crossbones and the devil over her head. And it was a very difficult time for her. But, you know, when you think about it, people, you can't blame listening to a radio show, for example, for inspiring somebody to do something that you don't. You are not in control.
He did hear her speak.
Yeah. And he did know that she did have tremendous respect for many of the people, especially in Europe, who had risked their lives in such acts.
And again, we talked about this a little bit earlier. She did try to explain where Chulgos was coming from.
Yes, she did. And it inspired her to write her essay called The Political Psychology, The Psychology of Political Violence.
Yeah.
And that was very, you know, I have to say that as the editor of the Emma Goldman Papers, this has been a big issue for me because I think I started as a feminist and I loved Emma Goldman's love, anarchy. Emma Goldman, I had no problem with her conflict between jealousy and free love. When it came to the issue of violence, it was very difficult to understand where was she really coming from, because very often she would say, anarchism is the opposite of violence. Anarchism is harmony. Anarchism is free association. It's communal gathering. It is not violence. On the other hand, she would say, this world needs to be reform.
Yeah.
Isn't doing it. Short of destruction, it's not going to change. You need to have a tremendous transvaluation of values and the culture and the institutions. And so it was hard to figure out. And as I wrote in the introduction to the first volume of Emma Goldman documentary History of the American Years Made for America, it was really finally this notion that these people were fighting a social war, that most nationalists have no problem with their soldiers going off to war and feeling patriotic and heroic about what they do. And she felt that these were the soldiers in the social war, in the class war, in the war of to establish a more equitable order. And therefore, I wouldn't say that she glorified them, but she honored them.
Yeah.
And that's where she was. And I don't think that she would have ever spoken directly. I mean, her letters say everything. That's all.
Yeah.
Her letters say all points. Yes, no, maybe, not sure.
Well, in preparing for this interview, the sense I got that she eventually came to a point where she thought that violence, somewhat useless, didn't work for what the aim was, and that mass political education was the better route to take.
I would say that is definitely, as a mass political educator and a fantastic spokesperson for ideas about education, drama, literature, labor, presents, all the stuff. She was amazing. But I actually think that she had a more nuanced sense about violence. Nuanced, not in the sense like, oh yeah, she's there, but more that she wasn't a pacifist, that she struggled with the fact that sometimes, in depending upon the circumstances and the situation, that might be necessary. And she, at the end of her life, was very active in the Spanish Civil War, supporting the Spanish anarchists of the Spanish Revolution. And so I would say that her emphasis was totally, had totally tamped down.
Yeah.
But her, she hadn't abandoned it completely. She hadn't abandoned her understanding of why that would happen completely, which I have to say sometimes is a problem for me, because I would say that I'm more of a pacifist. You know, I'm more on the Tolstoy side of anarchism.
Mm-hmm. And he rejected the term anarchist because of the reputation that it had with violence.
Yeah. And I think that's what we need to change. I think you look at the Occupy movement, you look at the young people who are so terrific, who identify as anarchists. And that is not, this is not like chaos, violence. This is, you know, mutual aid and understanding the hypocrisy of certain institutions and wanting to live a different kind of life. And I think we really have to not allow the right or even some of the left take that idea of anarchism and keep it in chaos and violence, because it will only discourage the people who's really at the core. It's really about freedom.
Again, we are in conversation with Dr. Candace Falk, author of the book Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman, a biography. She is the director of the Emma Goldman Papers, which is based out of UC Berkeley. Again, the topic this hour is the life and times of Emma Goldman, leading up to her eventual deportation from the United States to Russia. She was, again, Mother Earth, running a magazine, Mother Earth magazine, that in the world, and the lead up to World War One, was trying to encourage people, men, not to sign up for the war.
What she encouraged people was to affirm their right to choose. She did not say, don't sign up. She might have felt that way. But what she affirmed, which she felt was part of her principle of free choice, is that a draft was not just. And she looked around her audience of these really poor immigrant men who were young and had worked really hard and felt like you shouldn't have to fight if you don't want to. Mm-hmm. If you do, yes. In fact, some of the people who loved her the most, you actually felt positive about World War One. It was very difficult to sort out this idea of making the world safe for democracy. And the left was very split on that, including Kropotkin and Emma Goldman were split on that issue. And so the fact that she had the largest audiences probably that she'd ever had in her life around speaking about the draft, it then became clear that in a pre-war, as the country was going into a war footing, civil liberties were clamped down upon. And even colleagues of hers, comrades of hers, who stood on a rooftop and dropped leaflets, anti-war leaflets from a rooftop, got put in prison.
Yeah.
You know, and so she was put in prison and had a tremendously dramatic and eloquent trial, but ended up behind bars for 18 months. And there was Kate Richards O'Hare, a socialist, you know, Eugene Debs later.
And in jail.
It was a
running for president.
Yes, running for president.
Like 12% of the vote at the time.
Right.
Another remarkable.
Right.
Ralph Nader couldn't even get, and the Green Party can't even get the 5% of the vote to get some federal funding. Eugene Debs. I mean, again, it just really illustrates what a different time.
It was. And she was deported when she came out, I should say, when she came out in 1919. The Russian Revolution had taken place, and a Russian, somebody with Russian roots, anarchist, socialist, seemed much more threatening. And she was part of the first boat of deportees to leave the United States and be deported to Russia. And she was in it with all Russian anarchist socialists from who wrote for a magazine, a Russian magazine, and that was how much fear they had that it was external, that change was external. If only you could get rid of those people.
Yeah,
and of course, when she went to Russia,
became disillusioned with
the revolution. At first, so excited to give something of herself to the Russian Revolution. A lot of anarchists were part of the changes there. And she actually, early in her life, was hosted many people who were coming back and forth in preparation for the revolution. What she found was poverty and a lot of suppression of free speech again.
Yeah.
And suppression of anarchists.
And she writes a lot about this, about just replacing one...
One authority.
Autocratic leader for another.
Yeah. And that's the way she saw it. And
she met with Vladimir Lenin.
She met with Lenin. Lenin actually received a note that we have in our office from an assistant of his that said in Russian, "You must see Emma Goldman and Alexander Berkman, otherwise they will cause you some political trouble."
Yeah. Russia knew what it was getting.
And Lenin thought that free speech was a bourgeois prejudice. And so that's where we stand, is that I think that Emma Goldman, what is lasting, what is resonant, what is international, universal, is the desire for free expression. That is a right that's so fragile that even places with the best of intentions fear perhaps the truth, perhaps not the truth, but fear the persuasive power of the people.
Well, the history of the communist and anarchist relationship and sort of that split seems to go to this incident, the Kronstadt massacre.
Yes, because the Kronstadt sailors were massacred. They stood up. They wanted to take control of what they had. Actually, Paul Avrich wrote a beautiful book about it. And that the fact that they were massacred as if they were enemies horrified Emma. And she managed to get out of the country. She and Alexander Berkman managed to get out of the country by the end of 1920 and were in exile for the rest of their lives. But when she...
So they couldn't get back to the United States. She came back, I guess, for some speaking engagements, but always on temporary visas.
She was here once on a 90-day visa, and it was because Eleanor Roosevelt had read Emma's autobiography that she had written while she was in exile and thought it was wonderful.
What did she say? She said something, I think America can...
She said she thought America could handle the threat of Emma Goldman for 90 days.
Of an old lady. I think she called her or something.
And in fact, Emma was, like they called her, the grandmother. She came back looking like a grandma, you know. She was almost 70. But what I wanted to say is that in exile, she was not treated well by the left or the right. The left felt that she was a traitor by going against the Soviet, by standing up against Bolshevik Russia. The right already didn't like her because she was an anarchist.
But tell me more about the left.
The left felt in thrall, as many of the people we know and love did, to the Russian vision and could not believe that in the kind of suppression and brutality that actually happened.
And with that, Dr. Candace Folk has been our guest again. She's the author of Love, Anarchy, and Emma Goldman, a biography. She is the director of the Emma Goldman Papers, which is based at UC Berkeley. And people can also find more information and the papers themselves online. What's that website?
Yes, at HTTP.
Uh-huh.
I'm sorry.
Please
I'm
just
so
say www.
Yeah. Well, it would just be sunsite.berkeley.edu/Goldman. But one thing.
Sunsite.
Sunsite. It could also be library.berkeley.edu/Goldman. But one thing that I would hope that people who feel that it's important to hear about your history would take some portion of your giving, not all of it, because the world is so needy now, but like 10% to contribute to projects like the Emma Goldman Papers. We are completely self-reliant at this point on individual contributions and private donations. And I have this fantasy that when our book comes out very soon, if we could have parties all over the country and the world, the people who identify and love Emma Goldman are so varied and so feisty that they would love each other immediately and help us get to the next step.
Candace Folk, this was terrific. Thank you.
Thank you.